Welcome to TC Daily, the technology show brought to you by Tech Central. I'm Duncan MacLeod. If you haven't subscribed yet, please do so. You can go to youtube.com/TechCentral. And while you're doing that, why not subscribe to Tech Central's daily newsletter? You can do that at techcentral.co.za/newsletter. Now, I'm really excited about my next guest in the studio, someone I've been hoping to have on the show since we launched TC Daily, and that's Michael Markovitz, former SABC board member and now head of the Gibbs Media Leadership Think Tank. Michael, it's great to see you. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Pleasure, pleasure. Now, we're going to talk all about public broadcasting, broadcasting more broadly, even the whole media industry today. Lots of ground to cover. But we're going to start somewhere. So let's chat about your new role. And that's as head of the Gordon Institute of Business Science Media Leadership Think Tank. This is your baby, right? You came up with this idea. Tell me a bit about the think tank, what it does, what it hopes to achieve.
Well, thanks a lot for having me, Duncan. So the think tank is really what I would see as a knowledge generation, advocacy, policy research, not an institute, but it's really a platform that we've developed at Gibbs that focuses on the challenges faced by the media and how that impacts on democracy. I think that you probably know better than most is that the fragility of the media and the fragility of democracy has not just been an African problem, it's really been become a global problem in the last 10 years. So when my SABC term was, I could see the finish line, I thought, well, there's something that I would want to get into in more detail, and that's policy and the research areas about how do we sustain the media and the various challenges facing the media. And there's a sort of perfect storm at the moment where you've got sustainability issues, i.e. business models. Secondly, you've got the misinformation and disinformation and the tech platform and the power of the tech platform. And related to that, you've got the issue of digital competition, competition in the digital economy. So with those sort of cornerstones, we thought it'd be a good idea to set up a think tank to focus research and policy on those areas.
So what are you hoping to achieve with this think tank? What do you count as successes?
I would count as successes the ability to generate policy and research that has some influence potentially on all the different stakeholders. That would be government, civil society. And I think that, you know, you have to look around the world. There's a huge disproportionate think tank world out there in the global north, so to speak, in the northern hemisphere, where it's seen as a normal thing to do for different areas of policy, whereas in the global south, which South Africa is part of, it's there's far less. So what you're wanting to do is, yes, learn from what has already been done in Europe, in America, in other countries, but also develop solutions that take into account our particular situation. So yes, it is a grand aim. I take it as a grand target that one wants to achieve, but I think it's a needed plan because there's a dearth of African generated policy and research solutions for the media industry. When I say media, Duncan, just let me clarify. I do include tech policy as well because there's an overlap.
They've
there
converged. Between
yeah exactly. So it's not just the media as one knows it in terms of content and print, but obviously one's look at the tech platforms and social media as well.
And is the idea ultimately as well to influence government policy around some of these issues?
Well, I think that that's certainly one of the aims, and not just the South African government. We do want to be seen as a pan-African think tank, building links across the continent and developing, you know, solutions that are not just South Africa specific.
Now, Michael, you've just finished 5 years what would they call it? A civil service, I suppose, as a board member of the SABC. I'm glad to see you've emerged with relatively unscathed, with a head not full of grey hair at this stage. It must have been quite a trying experience, though, I imagine.
Well, you know, Duncan, in 2017, I put up my hand. Okay, so metaphorically speaking, when the SABC was in a crisis, which a lot of us tend to forget how bad it was.
Yeah, we would just come out of the period of Claudia Motsoeneng. I think many people forget that name. But the SABC had been run into the ground as a new board, you were inheriting a mess.
Yeah, we inherited a mess, but even before that, what we almost had a Zondo commission before the Zondo commission, because what a lot of people don't remember is it got so bad that Parliament had an inquiry and actually dissolved the SABC board that was running the show during Schladi's time, and they basically made a number of recommendations which, you know, they said the next board had to take up. But when we were appointed, and I thought, you know, look, now's the time, you know, for public service. Let me give my time. I'd spent a lot of time in the industry, in the public sector. I'd been at the regulator. I'd been at Prime Media. And I thought, let me see if I can add some value to the SABC board. So I stood when I had to go through a public interview and appointment process. And I was appointed in October 2017 with 11 others. And we inherited a beleaguered, mistrusted, and nearly insolvent public institution that had become part of the kleptocratic state capture project under former President Zuma. So, you know, it's media, as you know, survives on trust.
Yeah.
And rebuilding trust was really a very important, an important job. But we were very lucky because on the day of our appointment, and I think it was a serendipitous moment, is the Gauteng High Court came out with a judgment in SOS versus Minister of Communications, which said quite clearly that the minister was precluded from being involved with the board and that the board was exclusively in charge of the SABC. I'm paraphrasing. Mm-hmm. So with that judgment in mind, the board took office knowing that it had those independent powers. It had the independent powers to appoint an executive team. And that without the involvement of the executive arm of government. And I think that also clarified government's role. They then understood what their role was. And I think that was a very important start.
Mm-hmm. Helped a lot. Now, I must ask you this question. We've spoken over many years about the role of public broadcasting, and I think we've had some robust debates about the value of a public broadcaster. Are you more bullish or less bullish now than when you started about the role and importance of public broadcasting in the context of the South African landscape?
I'm bullish about the need. I'm not bullish about the sustainability. Okay. So on the need side, I believe that public media is a public good. What is a public good is something that is not easily replaceable. So you have to ask yourself the question, if there was no SABC, who would do vernacular broadcasting? Who would do the different types of local content that we do on radio? And I still say we, so let me just excuse that because 5 years is a hard habit to shake. But the SABC really has a role that is not easily replicable by the private sector.
Right.
So that's your starting point, you know. And then the second thing is that there's actually been a lot of studies around the world about the link between a well-funded, independently run public broadcast or public media, as people now like to call it, and the democratic health of a society. So there's that link that has been firmly established where public broadcasting is funded properly and run properly. There's a correlation, and I know correlation isn't causation, but a very strong correlation between a well-funded public broadcaster and a strong democracy. So I'm bullish on the need. The sustainability is a separate issue.
Yeah. I mean, something very clearly went wrong in the Zuma administration. The SABC was run into the ground. There was a crazy man running the show. Now, that was obviously not the intention of the legislation and all the regulations that sit around the SABC, yet it happened.
Yeah.
How do we stop it from happening again?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question, Duncan, because what you've pointed to is it's not just about a board or a management. It's the ecosystem. It's about the policymaker, government. It's about Parliament, the oversight, and it's about the regulator and the public. So you need a lot of things to work or, you know, reverse to go wrong for the SABC to fail or succeed, as the case may be. And you could ask yourself the question, well, why did the Schladi-Motsoeneng situation, was it allowed to develop? It was a failure of the ecosystem. It was a failure by Parliament until the very end, and credit to Parliament where credit is due. 2016, 2017, they saw what was happening, and they decided to form an ad hoc committee to investigate. And as I said, that led to the dissolution of the board. But there was a failure in during that time to take seriously what was going wrong. And I think the failure was also on the government side, is as we now know, the minister that was primarily running the SABC then was identified by Chief Justice Zondo as one of the implicated people in terms of allegedly being captured by the Guptas.
We're talking about Faith Mutambi.
Faith Mutambi. And, she was also involved in the unlawful removal of board members and the unlawful involvement, as that court judgment found. In fact, it was her behavior to the SABC that motivated civil society to litigate against the minister, that minister, and the SABC itself. Mm. So in a lot of ways, one can thank Faith Mutambi, because it was her behavior and involvement, as I said, that led to the clarity being given by the courts. Mm-hmm. And I say thank in inverted commas, but it did lead to a very important judgment, which is looked at around the continent mm-hmm. with a lot of envy, because most public broadcasters are seen as state broadcasters on the continent,
yeah.
where they're just simply seen as the mouthpiece of government. And, often
the SABC had come to be seen as that.
The SABC was seen as that. And yes, there were a lot of very good people working within the SABC. We had the stance of the so-called SABCA, who stood up to Sladi Motsoeneng's protest directive, where he directed that no protest should be shown or violent protest should be shown. And it was clearly, was over. That is kind of very naked editorial interference was overturned. But that, people did stand up. But ultimately, it was very difficult when the person and the board that was running the SABC at the time did not share the view that the SABC should be an independent public broadcaster and as a pillar of constitutional democracy. They didn't see it that same way. They saw it as an institution to be controlled either for narrow political ends or nefarious purposes.
That court judgment that you referenced, has that done enough, or do we need to see legislative changes? Do we need to see other measures to strengthen the corporate governance and the oversight of the SABC? I'm just asking this, what happens if we have another rogue president after Ramaphosa? What happens if we have a rogue communications minister who wants to come in there and appoint another Tladi Motsoeneng?
Yeah.
Have we got, are the procedures, are the rules sufficient now after that court judgment? Does that court judgment give enough precedent to stop that from happening again, or is there a risk that it could happen again?
I think there's always a risk that it could happen again. I think, America thought its institutions were pretty strong, and look how close they came to really almost a coup.
Yeah.
So I don't think one can ever be totally relaxed or complacent about these things. But what one would like to see is a lot of the elements of the judgment codified into legislation. And, the SABC has made substantive proposals to government about not only funding how the SABC should be funded in the future, but in terms of that governance clarifying those areas where the act is silent. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I do think it can be strengthened. But at the end of the day, I don't think any law is totally is the guardrail
foolproof
or bulletproof. I think one has to have the people that believe in upholding the Constitution that are selected for these important positions.
Right. So when you came in, the SABC the atmosphere there must have been pretty toxic. The newsroom fighting with Tladi Motsoeneng at the time. Yeah. The board, explain the role of a board member of the SABC. Is it different to a director of a JSE listed company? Are you more involved in running the day-to-day affairs of the business?
No. I mean, we are strictly not involved. We board members are strictly not involved in the operational affairs of the SABC. The board appoints the top three, the CEO, the CFO, and the COO. And there's normal quarterly oversight. But with a business and a company like the SABC, you end up having to meet a lot more than quarterly. A lot of issues come up that require the board to meet. And COVID fast-tracked a lot of digital services. So the board was able to meet quite easily over the pandemic. But, you know, one of the key things was for the board was to rebuild public trust, which is not easy, okay? You could just read what people thought about the SABC. Even 5 years in, Duncan, even though the SABC covered two elections and got a sort of bill of health from civil society organizations talking about the 2019 and 2021 elections, mm-hmm. that the SABC covered those elections fairly. That had never happened before where civil society said we're totally happy with it. Maybe back in the day in the mid-90s. But since then, I think SABC had lost its way. So I think the main thing was also to develop new editorial policies, and that was done in 2020. And those policies entrenched in a way the role of an editor-in-chief who was totally independent from the operation of the board and was protected by policy as well. So mm-hmm. I think those were some of the sort of trust-building mechanism the board tried to achieve in its time. And I think that there were a number of other elements where the board had to take a stand on certain matters. We had a very difficult labor process at the time, which most people are familiar with, which led to a lot of bitterly...
retrenchment program.
Yeah, the retrenchment process, the Section 189
that
process.
That was ugly.
It was terrible. It, you know, very difficult position for the board to be in, but if people, one of the things that you haven't mentioned is obviously the SABC survived that close to insolvency period by getting a bailout, mm-hmm. Which is a 3.2 billion rand bailout. And I often say that bailout was the unfortunate price of state capture, because it's one thing to take over a board and a corporation like the SABC. But when you find that there's no oxygen in the system, you can't remain permanently in ICU. Mm. So that bailout was necessary. But one of the conditions of the bailout was that the SABC had to address what was called a bloated workforce and the compensation element of the financials, which was seen as out of kilter. Mm. The board took a decision to do that. Management then implemented, and it was a highly, as you know, very difficult, involving people, very painful, very divisive. But the board took a view that it was something it had to do, and that it was actually required by Treasury in the first place. So that was difficult. It was very difficult.
Have you left the SABC in good financial health, or do you think there's a risk of it needing another bailout down the line?
Well, I cannot say we've left it in good financial health when it still made a just over 200 million rand loss in the last financials. But when we took it over, it was on a 1.4 billion loss. So on the one hand, you know, we've reduced the losses. But at the same time, we also, like the rest of the media, went through COVID. And the, you know, advertising revenues were badly hit. SABC also you know, and this is on the SABC, underspent on content on television. And so audiences dropped. And that's being addressed now. And, you know, there's a long cycle to turn that around, because it can be an 18-month process. So the SABC is certainly not out of the woods financially. You know, one has to be absolutely clear about that. And that is why we've made these proposals to government, because if you look at it, the SABC, and I've done the research on this, is probably one of the most commercially dependent public broadcasts on the globe.
It's around 80% of its revenue comes from advertising.
That's correct. You know, that's advertising and sponsorship,
right,
and other commercial revenue. And you've got 16% from license fees and only 3% from government grants. And often people talk about, oh, public money is being wasted. Yes, we are entrusted as a board. The board was entrusted to look after the SABC, which is a public entity and is under the PFMA. But, you know, the amount of ongoing government grants is only 3% of total revenue. And that is very unusual compared to other public broadcasters around the world. That is not sustainable, because you cannot have something which is at the same time a public good, but is really subject to the vagaries of a highly competitive industry and market forces. That's not to say SABC shouldn't compete on its own footing, but where you've got these critical public services, being dependent totally on advertising, you know, 80% is really a huge dependence. There needs to be a different look on how to sustain public broadcasting going forward.
So how do we sustain public broadcasting going forward is the next logical question, yeah. I guess. And I know there have been a lot of, I guess I'll call them clickbait headlines around license fees and what the SABC has proposed to government that it wants. What is it exactly that the SABC has proposed to government?
Okay, so I think that's an important lead-in, because I think there's been a lot of misinformation by clickbait media who seem to thrive on not only real misfortunes of the SABC, but they tend to sort of, you know, generate clicks out of imagined misfortunes. But really, we had to look at the license fee. Now, it's called a TV license fee. Now, it's an archaic concept. Let me be absolutely emphatic. It's an archaic concept to have a license fee that is linked to a piece of technology, which is only one way that media is consumed. SABC is the second biggest online news source in the country after News 24. A lot of people don't know that. They think, oh, there's this fuddy-duddy analog public broadcaster. It may be that in certain respects, but it's also the second biggest online news source. That's a major thing. Secondly, you know, the SABC is received across the country, even in the far rural areas, it's received by everyone on radios. It's received by people on phones. We've got an SABC News app, which is one of the things that happened under our term. So the first thing is to de-link it from a device. De-link the license fee from any device or consumer electronic product. And change the name of it and the definition of it as a public media levy or a public media household levy. Now, the basis is, and I see a lot of people saying, we don't use SABC, why should we pay for it? Around the world, the view is of public broadcasting, which is growing, and in particular the Germans have made this clear, is that it's not about whether you use it. It's about whether you've got a realistic possibility of accessing it, that it exists. And they've also made the link between financing public broadcasting and constitutional democracy. It's even gone up to their constitutional court, which held that it was valid. And if it ever got to that, I'm pretty confident our constitutional court would agree that the concept of some form of public financing for public interest programming is constitutionally valid. But that's the first thing, just to clear up that, first of all, it's not linked when you buy a TV set, okay? It shouldn't be linked about whether you use it or not, because there's no way of telling that, okay? And the third thing is, really, how do you collect it? Okay, that really was the big problem. And because there's no real consequence, it's seen as a grudge purchase, only one-fifth of households are paying, the SABC decided to come up with a proposal that the pay TV operator, a pay TV monopoly, MultiChoice, should be required by law to part collect the SABC public levy. In my own personal view, that should be extended to streaming operations that achieve scale. That was not what the SABC said, but I'm just giving my personal view. And the feeling there was it would be almost a public duty of these operators. They're not subsidizing the SABC. They're just using their collection mechanism, their payment mechanisms. And I would see it very similarly to what the airlines do, where you've got to pay a tax to AXA or you know, whatever airline taxes are. You've got private companies paying in a tax to sustain the airports. You look at tourism levies where, you know, it's collected on your hotel bill. You probably don't see it. It's at the bottom. And SABC was thinking of a similar thing, saying, look, you guys have got efficient payment mechanism. We're not asking you to collect from people who've already paid. Obviously, there needs to be a back-end system to establish whether people have already paid. And if they've already paid, there must be a way that they don't have to double pay. But to the extent that they haven't paid, they should be required by law to collect it. And I would imagine they could even be able to charge a collection fee for their troubles, because one of the complaints is, you know, why are you putting this extra burden on us? We've got so much else to worry about. Obviously, the reaction to that was not positive from MultiChoice, who said it would be globally unprecedented. They also called it mischievous and unfounded. And the last time I was called mischievous was probably 50 years ago. but, you know, on the serious side, you know, and I know a lot of good people who work at MultiChoice, so obviously this certainly isn't a personal thing. It's really is a policy issue. Is that MultiChoice had 30 years of no competition whatsoever. It was granted an exclusive license during the mid-80s, mid-apartheid, to the strongest media companies in the country at that time. It built a fantastic business, no question about it, but it had no competition, and that's also the fault. It's not the fault of MultiChoice, but it's the fault of the regulator, the fault of governments, but it grew into a situation where one could say it got used to monopoly profits. Now it's got some competition, sure, from streamers like Netflix, from Amazon, etc., but I think that, you know, that's normal. And that shouldn't be seen as a reason why this obligation shouldn't be taken seriously. Let's discuss it. Let's debate it. Because if you look at what's happening in Europe, European states are quite aggressive in requiring the streamers. And I know MultiChoice is also a streamer, but it's mostly a broadcaster. But they require the streamers, and there's a lot of laws in a lot of states at the moment being considered by parliaments to pay a subsidy towards public interest programming and European programming. And there are various proposals on that. This is not about the pay TV operator paying a subsidy. This is just being a collecting agency. And I think it's a lot softer than what's going on in the rest of the world. So, yes, while they may argue that it's unprecedented, and there isn't really a situation where it's saying it's not doable. It's doable.
Is there still a role for a public broadcaster, though, in this changing environment? Just taking these arguments you've made now, isn't there an argument to be made, if you believe there should be public service programming, that instead of MultiChoice collecting the fees and eventually passing them through to the SABC, that MultiChoice develops that public service programming itself, and that Netflix develops that public service programming itself, and that the SABC, if it can't stand on its own two legs, be allowed to disappear?
Well, no, I mean, I think I dealt with that at the outset as the concept of a public good. If you took away everything that the SABC does, and I think people tend to focus on the TV side.
Right.
You know, SABC is not just a TV operator. It's the biggest radio operator in the country, and most of those radio services are in vernacular languages. You know, I don't think your streaming companies and MultiChoice are about to get into radio, or, you know, even the private sector radio, if you look at it, is predominantly in English.
Mm.
So I don't think that's feasible to say that. I think one has to start from the point of view that public media cannot and will not and won't be simply replaced by the private sector and the services it provides. I mean, let's look at what the debate that's going on in the UK at the moment, where the Tories under the Johnson government proposed doing away with the BBC license fee. Now, the BBC is obviously the grand old public broadcaster, which spawned a lot of these in the colonies of the British Empire, Canada, Australia, and many countries in the Commonwealth have a very similar structure.
Yeah.
But the BBC has been a very successful public broadcaster, and the license fee was largely supported by the populace. Mm. You know, Johnson's decision to scrap it, and it hasn't happened yet, was described by one commentator as an act of political vandalism. Okay, and I understand what they mean, because where you've got a separate levy, if it's not working, fix it. If it's badly defined, redefine it. But why are separate levies important? It gives the broadcaster an independent source of funding that it doesn't have to go cap in hand for the whole bank shoot to the state, because then, you know, you are subject to political pressure. At the moment, the SABC only gets 3%, but often the SABC does need, like with the bailout, to get assistance. And the fact that we only collected, you know, 800-odd million last year, just over $40 million, it still pays for something. So I totally accept that the way that the current system is defined and conceived is archaic, and one could even argue broken, but it needs to be fixed, and we've tried to propose how.
Right. And what's the reception from government been on your proposals?
Well, from what we've seen, I think they like the concept of a household levy and sort of delinking it from a TV. But I'm still waiting to see the feedback on how it would be collected. And right. I think that's really the important thing.
Now, there's a piece of draft legislation that's been knocking around for quite some time now. I forget the full title. It's the audiovisual.
Well, there was a white paper on the audio and audiovisual content services framework, that's which right. I must disclose that I was part of the panel of experts that helped draft it. I'm not sure what the progress on that, but that was really looking at how to review our broadcast legislation. Right. I mean, our broadcast legislation, the founding act of the SABC is 23 years old. Mm-hmm. The Electronic Communications Act, which deals with broadcasting as well as telecoms, is 17 years old. And if you can just imagine what has happened in the space that you cover, that Tech Central covers in the last 20 years, it's an incredible change. So what we need is an expeditious review of the current legislation. And the drafters of the white paper and government which published it took a view that how the Europeans had done it is they defined it as, you know, that broadcasting would be just one subset of audio and audiovisual content services, because ultimately broadcast is a technology. Mm. There are many different ways and services, and that would also bring the streamers in and cover them. And how the Europeans do it is they require that the Netflixes have a domicile in Europe and set up an office, and so that they're not regulated as heavily as those who've got spectrum, but there are obligations certainly on online safety and takedowns and online harms, basically. So I think South Africa urgently needs to review its legislation, because it's one thing to say, you know, is the SABC viable? Why can't you achieve break even? Why are you having all these bailouts? Well, one bailout every 10 years, because the last one was 10 years before that. I think that the problem is that that's all fair criticism. But then the policy framework needs to be enabling the SABC instead of SABC competing with one hand behind its back.
So that legislation will then, if it becomes legislation, that's going to deal with the funding issues around the SABC.
Yes,
All contained in that white paper.
One hopes so. Yeah. There probably would need to be two different bills, one an SABC bill, which would amend the Broadcasting Act. Another would be an Electronic Communication Act amendment bill, which would amend that part of the legislation that deals with broadcasting. Whether it comes in together, I'm not sure. And I'm sure we're not there yet. But I think that the industry really welcomed it, because it doesn't just affect the SABC, it affects the private sector as well, and the community media sector. So I think it's urgent that we have an expeditious review and amendment of the legislation.
Am I right in thinking, though, the process seems to have stalled a bit?
I can't say for sure, Duncan. It's been a while since I checked exactly where it is. The last time I heard is that the department had taken oral and written submissions on the white paper, and I think they were now deciding the best course of action.
Okay, so there's something happening.
Something is happening.
Okay. I wanted to ask you just in the broad terms about the South African broadcasting landscape. You've spoken about how MultiChoice had a monopoly and was able to build up a dominant position in pay television. We've got one free, I think it's just one free, free-to-air competitor to the SABC in the form of ETV, which has built a number of products around that over the years. But just looking at the way the market is structured, we've got the streamers coming in. It's got StarSat, which came in to compete with MultiChoice. I don't think has done particularly well providing competition in the satellite pay TV market. And we've got the SABC. Just looking at top-down, the way the market is structured, what do you think is working well, and what needs to be fixed? And if there is stuff that needs to be fixed, how should it be fixed?
That's a tough question. I think the first thing is what we've just been talking about, is that the policy framework needs to be fixed.
Okay.
I think that once your policy framework is fixed, then I'd be more, you know, inclined to say what you're saying is, you know, let the games begin. Let people compete fairly on a very well-defined policy framework. But it's not really equitable. And the SABC has identified a number of areas. It's not just legislation, Duncan. It's also ICASA regulations that have been a problem for the SABC. In the one hand, there's obviously the well publicized must-carry rules, and there's also the sports rights area. And, you know, SABC felt that not only was the legislation outdated and needed to be changed, but regulations that had been passed, you know, 2008 and even earlier on both must-carry and must-carry was 2008, sports broadcasting was a while earlier. Time had moved on, and we, you know, one of the things that the board achieved was that ICASA did amend the must-carry regulations to say that there needs to be commercial negotiations between multi-choice, or didn't name multi-choice, but subscription broadcasters and the public broadcaster for the public broadcaster's TV channels. I understand that those negotiations have already started, and I don't know where they are at, but that started and that's progress. On the sports rights issue, sports is a public mandate issue, and obviously the public broadcaster has to acquire rights to cover national sporting events. But it found, when you talk about the market structure in the sports rights area was absolutely skewed, with the, you know, the situation that sports rights bodies, and I'm talking locally and sometimes internationally, would give all the rights. I will not give. Multi-choice would buy all the rights on all platforms, and even platforms that it doesn't use, and then SABC would be required to sub-license those rights from multi-choice. Mm-hmm. It was in the sub-licensing of those rights where SABC started encountering problems. One of them being was that multi-choice decided to require that SABC not show whatever rights were being acquired. I think one was the PSL. The other was when SABC was trying to acquire rugby rights. Is multi-choice said, yes, you can have these rights for whatever money was being asked for, but you can't show them on SABC Sports Channel, which is on OpenView and DTT and on streaming. You can only show them on a terrestrial network. Mm. Now, the SABC felt quite strongly and put it to multi-choice that that was, you know, anti-competitive. It was the dominant player and is the dominant player in sports broadcasting in South Africa. SABC launched a sports channel, which was another thing that happened under the previous board's term. And in order to get that sports channel working and SABC be able to deliver, it needed to acquire sports rights that it could show on that channel. And yes, that channel is on the OpenView platform. But it's irrelevant because it's an SABC channel. It doesn't matter where it's being carried. But Multishow stuck to its guns. And the consequence is that the SABC has now submitted, well, not now, a few months ago, a complaint to the Competition Commission, and that complaint is before them. I can't say much more about that now, but I, you know, can confirm that that complaint was put in, and it was about the sub-licensing of sports rights and the concerns about anti-competitive conditions. So market structure, there were changes that are required on the regulatory level and on the legislative level.
Right, right. There have been a number of complaints over the years to the Competition Commission. I remember StarSat also lodged a complaint at one point about licensing one of the SuperSport channels for the StarSat service, and it never went anywhere. They never see, the complaints about multi-choice at the Competition Commission never seemed to result in anything. Is that a fair comment, do you think?
I can't.
Unfair question, perhaps.
I think that's unfair. I think you asked the Competition Commission that.
Fair enough, fair enough. Let's talk then about digital migration. I'm sure this was a top-of-mind issue for you throughout your five-year tenure at the SABC. Given all we know now and how far behind this project is and all the disastrous steps along the way, how do you think this project, in hindsight, should have been done?
Well, that's a great question, Duncan. I mean, you know, often I say to people that when you look at the maladministration of the pre-2017, let's call it sort of the 10 years pre-2017, it wasn't just some of the allegedly and proven corrupt deals that were done. It was the deals that weren't done. Mm. It was the decisions that weren't taken that I personally believe were the most damaging. And what I mean by that, I mean that the SABC should have had its own box from the start, and that the SABC should have done exactly what MultiChoice does with its box, mm-hmm. control it vertically. In other words, decide on the technology of the box, install the box, be responsible for customer service for the box, and control the process from beginning to end. Mm. But unfortunately, what happened here was SABC did not do that. And government decided, in their wisdom at the time, to become involved in the procurement of these set-top boxes for the indigent. Mm-hmm. Okay, and that's where I think things started going wrong, because then the SABC suddenly was dependent on a technology platform where Centec is the distributor, but the box upon which it was its content was going to be carried, SABC had zero control over what type of box it was and the installation and verification of that installation. And I think that's where the problem started. And then successive boards came in, and there were debates about policy, which I won't go into here. You've covered it extensively. And I think really then one thing that the SABC had to be sure of is that, okay, you know, history is history. It's too late for SABC to get its box. Financially, it would not be possible now. You know, that ship has sailed, and that's why the SABC has done other platform deals, so it's not dependent on one platform. But the SABC is also dependent on the installation of those boxes in a critical mass of homes, particularly not just in the indigent, but also for people who are not indigent to be able to buy those boxes in the retail market. And that's been one of the concerns expressed by the board that I was a member of, was that they were concerned that this installation process had not gone as well as one had hoped, that the SABC was vulnerable. Remember, it was going to be switched off on the 31st of March. The SABC was vulnerable to being switched off, because a lot of its core audience are the poorer and most precariously poor people in South Africa, who don't have a voice, who were not able to phone up talk shows in the metros and complain about it when suddenly their screens went blank. But those audiences are SABC's core mandate audiences. And therefore, it was a huge risk to see the potential of those audiences being lost to the SABC and those audiences losing access to the public broadcasters' news services as well. So those were the concerns we'd expressed. I think it's been publicly reported what happened. The ETV took the minister to court. Eventually, the Constitutional Court found that the deadline was too aggressive, and now the minister is going to be consulting with the SABC, with the private sector, about a new switch off date. And I think that's a welcome thing. I think, and in the meantime, I think there's been more installations happening. But I do think that there's a concern for me is that there is a lack of alternative boxes apart from MultiChoice and OpenView on the retail market. And I think that there's a gap in the market for someone to take.
Right, right. I mean, but looking back at this thing, I mean, there were so many vested interests. So at one point, I remember Chris Becker of Naspers and the Minister of Communications at the time, Yunus Karim, having a public falling out with each other. I think that was probably the low point in this whole entire process. At the core of it, was this because politicians were trying to run the process, getting involved where they shouldn't have been in commercial decisions? And how much of a finger do you think we should be pointing at companies like MultiChoice, like ETV, which insisted that there be conditional access in these set-top boxes, encryption in these set-top boxes? I mean, where can we point fingers here? Or is everybody kind of to blame?
You know, I think you've answered your own question there. I think that, look, I think it's up for journalists, for academics, to look at this period and properly study what went wrong and why. All I can say as a former SABC board director, what I would have certainly wanted to do if I was a director at that time when the events that you talk about were happening, and that would have been to push for SABC to have more control over its own destiny.
Right.
Losing that control has hurt SABC on the TV side and made it more vulnerable. Who's to blame? What was the policy decisions at the time? Were they correct? Weren't they correct? I think I'll leave that for
historians
and journalists like yourself.
All right. Thanks, Michael. Before I let you go, let's talk a little bit about the future. So streaming is taking over. Certainly there's a huge role, especially in the African and South African context, for traditional linear broadcasting still, data affordability being an issue, et cetera, et cetera. But that's changing. We had the CEO of Vumatel in here a few days ago who talked about rolling out fiber into the townships, and not only into the townships, but also into you know, areas where it was inconceivable that fiber would be rolled out before, never mind mobile services. Mm. And he's talking about doing this for less than 100 rand a month for uncapped fiber, which potentially changes everything in the media game in South Africa. But let's look at the rise of streaming. And we've seen, certainly at the top end of the market, services like Netflix and Amazon and Apple TV Plus and all of these things entering the market. It's become very competitive. MultiChoice is feeling that competitive pressure more than at any time in its history. Mm. What does this all mean for the public broadcaster?
Okay.
Is streaming the future of public broadcasting as well? And how does the SABC, if it is, how does the SABC get ready for this new era?
I think the SABC is very well aware of what it needs to do in this space. I think it made announcements previously through our management at the time that the SABC needed its own streaming platform, because what the SABC has got, which the other streamers don't have, and of course the SABC doesn't have what they've got, is multi-billion dollar content budgets.
Yeah.
But what the SABC does have is an incredible resource of indigenous language programming on audio and on TV. Mm-hmm. The archives are currently being digitized at hundreds of thousands of hours a year. The digitized archives of the SABC could become the pot of gold underneath a streaming platform for the SABC in terms of the depth of that platform. No one suggests for 1 minute that the SABC is going to come out and compete head on with these global platforms and with MultiChoice, because they're covering a particular niche of high-end premium content. SABC needs to obviously produce good local content and acquire some competitive international content, but it needs to also make its offering available in a way that's affordable, because it'll be free, but it also data is the challenge. Mm. And I think, you know, you're saying that the infrastructure players and the service providers are bringing that cost down. I think that's very important, sir, because SABC would need to cater for audiences that may not be able to afford streaming. And so I think it's important that when they launch a streaming service, which is very much on the cards, hopefully in 2023 it'll be its SABC's own streaming service, that it becomes the future of the SABC. Mm. Because everyone who can afford data, that is, let me just qualify it, consuming media on their phones and their devices, and SABC is very well aware of it, but unfortunately and fortunately, when SABC or anyone who's subject to the PFMA does a procurement of that size, it's obviously a much more time-consuming process, but when I say fortunately, we've had too many issues in the past where tech in the public sector has not led to good outcomes. Mm. There's been a lot of challenges, well reported in on your site as well, on just big tech projects that have failed dismally in municipalities and government departments, and we don't want to see that again. Mm. We want SABC to come out with a properly procured platform that is best of breed and that can, you know, be attractive. Mm. And that the SABC is not seen as just old technology, old content, that it has new, fresh content that it's able to attract a younger South African viewer and listener to. And I'm pretty confident if that platform can be launched in 2023, that new journey can begin for the SABC and play a part, hopefully, in the sustainability of the public broadcaster.
What are we looking at here? I mean, is it going to be something like the BBC's iPlayer? That level of sophistication?
Look, all I can say without getting, I mean, the tender details were public in terms of the specs that people wanted, but that's very similar to what the AIM was. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, when the BBC iPlayer launched, it was like a hey wow moment for everyone, but now it's quite a common platform. What I like personally about the BBC iPlayer was that you had to put your license fee number in to get access to all the content. So while it's not a subscription platform, it's saying, well, it recognized whether you'd done your public duty by paying the license fee. And I think when one's talking about others collecting the SABC's license fee. That is not to say the SABC is absolved from collecting it for itself. It must carry on. It's just to collect from those who haven't paid the SABC directly.
Michael, we could talk all afternoon. There's so much to talk about in this space, but we have to call it at some point. It's always great to chat to you. Let's get you back into the studio at some point and talk all matters broadcasting and media. Michael Markovitz is head of the newly created Gibbs Media Leadership Think Tank and until recently an SABC board director. Thanks for a great discussion.
Thanks for having me.